Well met, and welcome to episode 124 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 20th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we kick off our three-month-long discussion of King Lear with a quick intro and a not-so-quick plot synopsis. So, it's been a long time since I've read King Lear, probably a quarter of a century. I just cringed at that. Man, I'm old, but not as old as Lear. I always loved Lear on the page. Structurally, I remember it as brilliant. I've seen the play a couple of times in these intervening years, and what I've always felt is somehow let down by what's on stage. But it's understandable. There's so much on the page, how could you possibly get it all on stage? As I begin this new reading of the play, I'm wondering if I'll feel the same way when our time together is done. If anything, from afar, I see even more angles that this play can provide. My wife's grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's before she passed. I've always seen a certain senility in Lear, but was it dementia? In some ways, I'm really looking forward to this new reading of the play. I can't wait to wade into it. On the other hand, with my father's passing and my wife's mother's recent health problems, the whole parent coming to the end of their time thing is tinged with a personal sadness that goes well beyond the genre of tragedy, and I'd like to keep that at arm's length for as long as possible. 3 months of this ambivalence should be, well, if nothing else, interesting. King Lear begins with an epic first act. Only Richard III's 1,000-plus line behemoth is longer. Epic first act, but quiet opening moment. A discussion between two lords, earls really, Kent and Gloucester, about current political events. It seems the Dukes of Albany and Cornwall are equal in the king's love, so weighed. We don't know it yet, but these dukes are the husbands of Lear's older two daughters, Goneril and Regan, respectively. The two dukes are equally loved, so there's no current conflict, and thus the subject changes from domestic politics to matters of domesticity. When Kent asks if the third person on stage, the handsome, so proper Edmund, is Gloucester's son, we learn that he is, but from out of wedlock. Edmund is a bastard, some year younger than his legitimate brother. If such casual discussion of the son's bastardy isn't bad enough, Gloucester goes on to make bawdy remarks about Edmund's mother, saying that there was good sport at his making. This quiet opening doesn't last long, however. Within minutes, we have Lear enter with his daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia, and the Dukes of Albany and Cornwall. The king calls for the lords of France and Burgundy to be brought in. We learn that these two men are suitors, great rivals in our youngest daughter's love. Lear has decided to retire from rule, dividing his kingdom between the three daughters. As prelude to discussing that division, though, he wants to hear the women proclaim their devotion. Which of you, shall we say, doth love us most, so that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge? The two older sisters proclaim their love in escalating terms, all the while Cordelia reveals and asides her discomfort with the entire endeavor. Lear gives each daughter ample thirds of the kingdom, then asks Cordelia, "What can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sisters?" Her answer is shocking and begins a back and forth with the king that spirals out of control. Cordelia, "Nothing, my lord." Lear, "Nothing?" Cordelia, "Nothing." Lear, "Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." She supports her answers with a cogent, logical argument, but what she fails to understand is that logic is not what her father is looking for. He wants love, devotion, even worship. And within two dozen lines, Lear has disowned her, disclaiming all his paternal care. Kent attempts to intervene, only to come between the dragon and his wrath. Lear has Albany and Cornwall divide Cordelia's third of the kingdom, splitting the rule two ways, no longer three. Kent again tries to speak reason to Lear, but to no avail. Lear sends Kent off into exile, proclaiming that If he is found in the country 10 days from now, the punishment is death. With Kent's exit comes the lords of France and Burgundy, who are offered a dowerless marriage to Cordelia. Burgundy refuses outright, but France asks what has happened. Cordelia explains, obliquely, and this is all France needs to take Cordelia because, as he says, she is herself a dowry. Burgundy is unimpressed, and he leaves with Lear and the entourage, leaving only France and the sisters on stage. Cordelia, in saying goodbye to her sisters, pleads for them to love well their father, all the while fearing what plighted cunning hides. Both sisters bristle at her words, and when she and France leave, Goneril and Regan discuss how full of changes Lear's age is, and how he hath even but slenderly known himself. They fear his rashness that they've seen before, and now with Kent's banishment. While Regan feels that they need to think on the situation, the older sister Goneril says they must do something. And if this was my first rodeo or reading of the play, I might think that these two were just being rational, in much the same way as Claudius doesn't seem guilty in the first scenes of Hamlet. But it isn't my first reading of the play, and now all of their statements carry with them ominous overtones. And with those overtones hanging over our heads, the first scene of the play ends. Act 1, Scene 2 begins with the play's first soliloquy. From the mouth of that handsome bastard we met at the beginning, Edmund, he speaks an invocation, a quasi-prayer. Not to God, though, but to nature, to which he pledges his service. You might have had an internal debate or three about the concept of nature versus nurture, but not Edmund. He sees society and external forces as the plague of custom and rails against said society for its concept of bastardy. And before the scene is less than 20 lines old, we have his clearly stated motivation. Legitimate Edgar, I must have your land. And almost as quickly, we see his methodology. When his father Gloucester enters, Edmund hastily puts away a paper. Gloucester takes the bait, asking what the paper is. Edmund says, "It is a letter from my brother that I have not all or read, and for so much as I've perused, I find it not fit for your or looking." Gloucester demands the letter, then reads it, finding a veiled request for conspiracy against the life of the old man. As quickly as Iago turned Othello against Desdemona in our last play, Edmund turns Gloucester against Edgar. Edmund promises his father that he will learn more from his brother and report back to him. Gloucester leaves, bemoaning these late eclipses in the sun and moon. Edmund soliloquizes on the excellent foppery of such astrological beliefs, and as if on cue, Edgar enters. Edmund questions Edgar if he has offended their father lately, citing Gloucester's displeasure. Edgar is sure, ironically, that some villain hath done him wrong, and Edmund, playing the good brother, promises to bring the two of them together. But just in case, he advises his half-brother to go armed. Two scenes into King Lear, and we have two father figures, each mistaking good children for bad. When the short Act 1, Scene 3 begins, the scene has shifted to Goneril in the Duke of Albany's castle. It seems that one of Goneril's gentlemen has chided Lear's fool and had been struck by Lear for the remark. Goneril is not happy with this and tells her steward Oswald that she has grown tired of her father's antics and those of his knights. She says that she will refuse to speak with him when he returns from hunting. She also gives Oswald permission to disrespect him as well, to put on what weary negligence Oswald pleases. She realizes this may anger Lear, but she doesn't care, saying that he can go stay with Regan if he's unhappy. In case of this, Goneril will write straight to her sister to hold her course. It seems that Cordelia's opening scene fears of poor treatment of her father at the hands of her sisters were founded in reality. In Act 1, Scene 4, Kent appears disguised and in other accents, ready to continue to serve Lear, even though he's been exiled by the old king. And when Lear enters, Kent offers his services to keep honest counsel and to deliver a plain message bluntly. Irony alert, that's what got him exiled in the first place. Lear takes him on, at least for the short term. Oswald enters and exits, ignoring Lear. One of the king's knights arrives to inform Lear that it is his belief, though he admits that he may be mistaken, that the king is not entertained with that ceremonious affection as he is wont. It's an interesting statement. It makes one think that the whole "tell me who loves me most" contest from the first scene was a recurring game in the Lear household. The knight is not mistaken, as we know from the previous scene, and even Lear has felt it. I have perceived a most faint neglect of late, which I have rather blamed as mine own jealous curiosity than a very pretense and purpose of unkindness. It is at this point that we learn more of Lear's fool. He's been missing for the last 2 days, and since Cordelia's going into France, the fool hath much pined away. Lear doesn't want to hear of that daughter, instead saying he wants to talk to Goneril. One can only imagine that mention of the fool has brought this needed discussion to mind. With perfect timing, Oswald enters. When Lear attempts to engage him in conversation, Oswald disrespects him by calling him Goneril's father rather than king. Lear strikes him for this, and when Oswald says that he will not be treated in this way, Kent trumps him. Kent now has a job with the king. Oswald runs off, and the fool enters. The fool asks Lear if he can hire Kent as well, offering Kent his coxcomb, or fool's cap, since anyone who would follow Lear must needs wear the coxcomb. And despite threats of the whip by Lear, the fool continues to mock his master. Goneril arrives to chide her father for allowing not only the fool, but his knight followers to be insolent and take part in not-to-be-endured riots. Worse, she insults him. "As you are old and reverend, should be wise." The old king can't believe what he's hearing. "Dost any here know me? This is not Lear. Does Lear walk thus, speak thus? Where are his eyes? Either his notion weakens, his discernings are lethargied. Ha, waking? 'Tis not so. Who is it that can tell me who I am?" The fool's response? Lear's shadow. Sad to say, the fool may be onto something here. If a king's power can be seen in the size of his army or even his retinue, Lear's power is about to be reduced. Or as Goneril demands, "a little to disquantity your train of 100 knights." Lear responds rashly, calling for his horse and saying, "Yet I have left a daughter." He berates Goneril and poor Albany, who enters the chaos. Lear goes as far as to curse his own daughter, invoking nature to make her sterile, and if that doesn't work, then to create her a child of spleen. Leaving, he drops a verbal bomb that still gets used today. "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child." In Lear's absence, she sends Oswald with a letter to Regan, in which she has outlined her particular fear, and even allows Oswald to add to the letter such reasons of his own that may compact it more. When Albany tries to calm his wife, she is full of wrath and criticizes his milky gentleness and harmful mildness. In the short first act closing scene 5, Lear too sends a letter to Regan, this one by his new man, the disguised Kent. The fool attempts to distract Lear from his anger, but all it does is create a fear in Lear. "Oh, let me not be mad, not mad, sweet heaven. Keep me in my temper, I would not be mad." And with this ominous bit of foreshadowing, the first act of King Lear comes to a close. Act 2, Scene 1 takes us back to Gloucester's house, and news that Regan and her husband Cornwall are heading there for a visit, with rumors, whispered, ear-kissing arguments, regarding a possible war between Cornwall and Goneril's husband Albany. Edmund, in soliloquy, sees the impending visit as something to incorporate into his plot, his business. Mnemonic device, by the way. Edgar, with a G, is the good brother. Edmund, with the M, is the malevolent one. Just saying. When the good Edgar appears, the malevolent Edmund goes into overdrive with his plot. He tells Edgar that his father is out looking for him and that Edgar must fly this place. He also asks if Edgar has spoken against Cornwall, as Cornwall and Regan are coming. Now, technically, there's quite a bit of truth in what Edmund says. Methinks he took the online Iago equivocation course, but we know this is all part of the plot. He goes on to tell his brother to draw his weapon, so he will look to have defended himself. Why, you may ask? Go ahead, ask. I don't know, except that maybe the G in Edgar is really for gullible rather than good. Edgar flies, sword in hand, and Edmund wounds himself. His father Gloucester arrives to find the bastard Edmund bleeding and the legitimate gone. Edmund goes on to say that Edgar tried to kill him when he wouldn't be persuaded to the murder of Gloucester. Gloucester announces that with Cornwall's help, he will have Edgar hunted down. In the meantime, Gloucester will work the means to make Edmund capable of inheriting Gloucester's lands and title. Cornwall and Regan arrive. They are dismayed by the actions of Edgar, Lear's own godson. Regan asks if Edgar was not companion to the riotous knights that tended upon her father. Gloucester doesn't know, but Edmund says it's so, linking bad Edgar to Lear. Again, why? I don't know. Regardless, Regan and Cornwall heap praise on Edmund, and Gloucester is one proud daddy. Elsewhere in Gloucester's castle, both Kent and Oswald arrive separately, having already delivered their respective letters to Regan. Oswald doesn't recognize Kent from their earlier meeting, but Kent has no such problem, and he is relentless in his insults of Oswald. A knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted, stocking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking, whoreson, glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, one trunk-inheriting slave, one that would be a bawd in way of good service, and art nothing but the composition of a knave, beggar, coward, pander, and the son and heir of a mongrel bitch, one whom I will beat into clamorous whining if thou deniest the least syllable of thy addition. And that, my friends, is how you insult in Shakespearean. When Oswald does deny, Kent draws his sword to give him the promised beating, which is precisely the moment when Cornwall, Regan, Gloucester, and the bastard, my text's words, not mine, enter. After some entertaining back and forth, including Cornwall's distrust of plainness and Kent's response out of his dialect in flowery verse, Kent is found to be guilty in the eyes of Cornwall and is put in the stocks. Cornwall pronounces the punishment to last until noon, but Regan demands till night, and all night too. Left alone in the stocks, Kent has time to read a letter he has received from Cordelia, who has most fortunately been informed of Kent's disguise and further loyalty to the king, a letter that intimates that she will return, seeking to give losses their remedies. Act 2, Scene 3 is a short soliloquy by Edgar, who tells us of his plan to evade the hunt by disguising himself both physically and behaviorally as a bedlam beggar, a former patient of London's Bedlam Insane Asylum. He used to be heir to nobility. Now he says, Edgar, I nothing am. Act 2, Scene 4 takes us back to Gloucester's castle, where Lear and the Fool arrive to find Kent in the stocks. When Kent tells Lear who put him in the stocks, the old king is incredulous. And after Kent explains what has happened, Lear exits to find his daughter and her husband. Kent and the Fool have a little banter, and Lear returns. Not with Regan and Cornwall, but rather with Gloucester, who tries to explain that they have refused to see him. Lear cannot believe this slight, railing against the insulting treatment to a king. He sends Gloucester to bring Regan and Cornwall, which he does. Kent is set free, and Regan voices her gladness to see her father. He tells her that he believes her, otherwise he'd have to say her mother's tomb holds an adulteress. Her sister, he continues, is filled with sharp-toothed unkindness like a vulture. When Lear tries to tell her of his perceived indignities, Regan cuts him short. You less know how to value her desert than she to scant her duty. What she means by this is that he doesn't appreciate Goneril's words and actions any more than Goneril would know how to shirk her duty as a daughter. Lear cannot abide by Regan's interpretation that Goneril was right in the actions she took to restrain the riots of his followers, but Regan tells him to return to Goneril and ask her forgiveness. Lear refuses, again raining curses upon her. Regan asks if he would ever curse her so, but Lear says that he wouldn't because she would never do to him what Goneril has. Then Goneril arrives and is welcomed warmly by Regan, who again tells her father what to do. If, till the expiration of your month, you will return and sojourn with my sister, dismissing half your train, come then to me. I am now from home and out of that provision which shall be needful for your entertainment. Lear refuses, again, first claiming he would rather abjure all roofs, and then he changes his mind, saying that he'll stay with Reagan with his 100 knights. Reagan again says that she is not prepared for him, but that she may take him in if he brings but 25 knights. At that, he says he'll go with Goneril and his 50 knights, but within mere lines, the daughters question the need for even a single knight. He rails against his daughters, calling them unnatural hags, promising such revenges on them both, and lamenting, "Oh fool, I shall go mad." Now, is it foreshadowing if it's already happening? Anyway, with that, he leaves with Kent and the fool. And even with a storm coming, the daughters promise that neither will take in the old king if he has even a single follower. Lear heads into the storm and into Act 3. Act 3, Scene 1, takes us onto the heath in the storm. In the mere line since their exit in Act 2, Lear, the fool, and Kent have become separated. The disguised Kent runs into another of Lear's gentlemen, who knows only that the king and the fool are contending with fretful elements. Kent tells the gentleman that he knows of division between Albany and Cornwall, the husbands of Lear's oldest two daughters. And how does he know this? French spies who have been working as servants in the houses have given hints not only to the duke's dealings, but also the hard reign which both of them have borne against the old kind king. Kent gives the gentleman a purse with something else that he once delivered to Cordelia if the gentleman should ever see her, saying, "Fear not, but you shall." A ring which will reveal Kent's identity to her, which she will then reveal to the gentleman. And with that, they go their separate ways in an attempt to find Lear. The second scene of the act takes place elsewhere on the heath, with Lear and the fool wandering in the storm. The old king curses the storm, and he has no illusions as to what he has become. A poor, infirm, weak, and despised old man. Even as such, he calls upon the storm to attack his two pernicious daughters. Kent finds Lear and the fool, but this does nothing to stop the king's rant. Calling out the wretches of the world, guilty of so many crimes, Lear finds himself more sinned against than sinning. When Kent tells Lear of a hovel nearby, Lear begins to show pity for his fool, showing not only concern, "How dost, my boy?" but also empathy. "Art cold? I am cold myself." It's almost as if Lear's words, "My wits begin to turn," are more than just wishful thinking. And the trio exits to the hovel. In Act 3, Scene 3, Gloucester confesses to Edmund that he is feeling sympathy for the old king, and misgivings for conveying these feelings to Reagan and Cornwall. "They took from me the use of mine own house, charged me, on pain of perpetual displeasure, neither to speak of Lear, entreat for him, or any way sustain him." When Edmund voices sympathy, Gloucester counsels him to say nothing. Gloucester, too, has heard of a division between the dukes, as well as a foreign power already footed in England to revenge the king's hardships. He has learned this via a letter that he has locked away in his room. Gloucester has decided to side with the king and will go to look for him. In the meantime, he counsels Edmund to maintain talk with the duke. Gloucester may not care for his own life, which is threatened by his actions, but he wants his son to be careful. Once Gloucester leaves, Edmund in soliloquy tells us that he's going to immediately tell Cornwall what he knows and show him the letter too. After all, he says, the younger rises when the old doth fall. Act 3, Scene 4 takes us back to the heath, where Lear, the fool, and Kent have found the hovel. Kent tries to convince Lear to enter, but Lear refuses, saying that the storm isn't affecting him as much as the tempest in his mind doth from his senses take all feeling else, except for his emotions towards his daughters. Even that, though, he tries to bury, as that way madness lies. Lear sends the fool into the shelter of the hovel, and then speaks of his growing connection to others, to feel what wretches feel. This introspective moment is cut short, however, by a different voice within the hovel, Edgar's ramblings as the bedlam beggar, poor Tom, and the fool's fearful response. The two emerge, Edgar bemoaning the foul fiend that follows him. If Lear had seemed to be gaining lucidity before, it now slips from him again, as he asks Edgar, "Didst thou give all to thy daughters? And art thou come to this? Couldst thou save nothing? Wouldst thou give them all? Empathy, maybe. Still fixated on his own problem? Most definitely. The fool punctures the moment with some comedy slash stage direction, though. Nay, he reserved a blanket, else we would have all been shamed. So Edgar is naked, save for the blanket. Lear still tries to tie poor Tom's fate to unkind daughters. Lear also sees poor Tom as the essence of man. Thou art the thing itself, and thus begins to take off his own clothing to become one with the bedlam beggar. It is into this scene that Gloucester enters, called a dancing devil, foul, fliberted gibbet by Edgar. Does he recognize his father? There is no definitive answer via aside or soliloquy. Gloucester wants to take Lear into the hovel, one imagines for safekeeping, or at least to get him out of the storm. But the king is more interested into talking with this philosopher, this same learned Theban, poor Tom. While the two talk to each other apart from the rest, Gloucester laments the state of things, especially his and Lear's torment at the hands of their children, ironically telling Kent, who remembers in disguise, "Ah, that good Kent. He said it would be thus, poor banished man." Lear relents, and the group enters poor Tom's hovel. The short fifth scene of the act takes us back to the Gloucester castle, where Cornwall, having heard of Gloucester's treacherous support for Lear, rails against the old man to the bastard son Edmund, even going so far as to say, "It is not altogether your brother's evil disposition that made him seek Gloucester's death, but a provoking merit set awork by a reprovable badness in Gloucester himself." Cornwall tells Edmund that his father's actions and Edmund's loyalty hath made Edmund Earl of Gloucester. Act 3, Scene 6 takes place in the hovel where, according to Kent, all the power of Lear's wits have given way. Gloucester leaves to find help for the king, who begins another rant and a kind of verbal trial against his daughters. Kent convinces Lear to rest. Lear asks for quiet for his nap and says, "We'll go to supper in the morning," to which the fool says, "And I'll go to bed at noon." Why do I mention this seemingly throwaway line? Because this is the last we will hear from or see the fool. Like Benvolio in Romeo and Juliet, the fool simply vanishes from the play. Gloucester returns with news that there is a plot of death upon Lear, and they need to get him to safety. Gloucester tells Kent to get the king to Dover, where they shall meet both welcome and protection. Now, Dover's at the sea, one of the nearest points of the English coastline to the French mainland. Any bets on who that welcome and protection will be? Can you say Cordelia? I knew you could. The scene ends with them bearing the sleeping Lear away. The seventh and final scene of the third act is back at Gloucester's castle. Cornwall, Regan, Goneril, Edmund, and others learn that the army of France is landed in England, and Cornwall orders some servants to seek out the traitor Gloucester. And what will they do with him? Regan wants to hang him instantly, while Goneril votes for plucking out his eyes. Cornwall, as if sensing how unpleasant this must be for Edmund to hear this, tells Edmund to escort Goneril back to her castle, especially since the revenges upon his traitorous father are not fit for his beholding. So off go Goneril and Edmund. Within a half dozen lines, servants bring in the captured Gloucester. Cornwall has him bound, and Regan and her husband hurl insults and accusations at the old man. Regan, in a show of major disrespect, even plucks at Gloucester's beard. They demand to know where he has sent the king, and Gloucester tells them the truth, Dover, even explaining why he did so. "Because I would not see thy cruel nails pluck out his poor old eyes, nor thy fierce sister in his anointed flesh stick boorish fangs, but I shall see the winged vengeance o'ertake such children." Now, if you're counting, that's two pluck-out-eyes references in this scene alone. And we're not done. Cornwall says that Gloucester will not live to see vengeance upon the daughters. "Upon these eyes of thine I'll set my foot," and he puts out one of Gloucester's eyes. This act brings out the worst and best in those who see it. No pun intended. Regan says that one side of Gloucester's face will mock another. The other eye, too, should be removed. A nameless servant stands up for Gloucester to Cornwall. The servant wounds Cornwall before Regan kills the servant, and Cornwall puts out Gloucester's other eye. Gloucester's life is now all dark and comfortless, and he bemoans the absence of Edmund, who he's sure would avenge this cruel act. Regan tells Gloucester that it was Edmund who told them of Gloucester's treasons, and it is only now that Gloucester realizes his follies, and that Edgar was abused. He prays to the gods to forgive him and to allow Edgar to prosper. Regan has Gloucester kicked out of the castle, and then learns that Cornwall's injuries are worse than originally thought. He bleeds apace and must receive first aid. And with that bloody scene, Act 3 ends. Act 4 begins on the heath, with Edgar still using his poor Tom of Bedlam identity. Alone, he soliloquizes on his lowly state, but reveling in it. To be worst, the lowest, and most dejected thing of fortune stands still in esperance, lives not in fear. Had he been a king, had power, he would live in fear. From his state, though, things can only get better. He can only return to laughter. Or so he thinks. It can get worse, and it does. He sees his father being led by an old man. Gloucester wants the old man to leave him, fearing that any help the old man gives him may hurt him. The old man refuses to leave him because he cannot see his way. Gloucester responds, "I have no way, and therefore want no eyes. I stumbled when I saw." He laments his state, but hopes to see Edgar in his touch, to which Edgar can only say in aside, "Who is it can say I am at the worst? I am worse than e'er I was, and worse I may be yet. The worst is not so long as we can say this is the worst." This could well be the moral of the rest of the story of this play. When the old man recognizes Edgar as poor Tom and calls him a madman, Gloucester remembers seeing him the night before. Gloucester ironically admits, "My son came into my mind, and yet my mind was then scarce friends with him." Gloucester again asks the old man to leave him, now to leave him with the naked beggar. The old man agrees and leaves to bring Tom some better clothes. Gloucester gives him a purse with money, asking him to take him to Dover, and promises that if he brings Gloucester to the very brim, he'll give poor Tom a greater reward, and from that place Gloucester shall no leading need, implying that he will commit suicide. Edgar agrees, and they head towards Dover. Act 4, Scene 2 takes us to Goneril and Albany's castle, where Goneril and Edmund are greeted by Oswald, who informs Goneril that Albany is a changed man. He had smiled when informed of the invading army, said Goneril's arrival was worse, and when told about Gloucester's treachery and of Edmund's loyal service, he told Oswald that the steward had the story backwards. Goneril tells Edmund that he shouldn't be there and sends him back to Regan with directions for Cornwall to prepare for war. She means to take over the martial role of the house and to give the distaff into her husband's hands. She will become the man of the house. She kisses Edmund before he leaves, and he pledges that he is hers in the ranks of death. When Albany enters, he has no such pledge for her, instead telling her, "You are not worth the dust which the rude wind blows in your face." As they continue to trade insults, a messenger arrives with news, the Duke of Cornwall's dead. When Albany hears the whole story, Gloucester's eyes, the servant protecting him, he praises divine justice in punishing Cornwall. Goneril exits after admitting in an aside, "Regan being widow, and my Gloucester with her, may all the building in my fancy plug upon my hateful life." So, Goneril fancies a future with Edmund, and now fears that Regan, being a legitimate widow, see what I did there, will have the upper hand and ruin Goneril's fantasy of being with the bastard. When Albany learns that it was Edmund who brought about Gloucester's torture, Albany vows revenge for the now blind old man. In the short Act 4, Scene 3, the French army arrives, led by Cordelia. She has seen, or has received reports of, her father wandering in the fields, mad as the vexed sea, and crowned with weeds. She sends out men to find her father. She receives additional news that the English army is marching toward her position, but she says that she was expecting this. She says that she is there in England not because of blown ambition, but love, dear love of her father. Act 4, Scene 4 takes us back to Gloucester's house, where Regan receives information from Goneril's steward, Oswald. While Albany is leading Goneril's army, Oswald says that Goneril is the better soldier. Oswald has a letter to give to Edmund, but he's not there. Regan has realized that it was a mistake to let Gloucester live, and she thinks Edmund has gone, in pity of his misery, to dispatch his knighted life. If this is true, Edmund is a real bastard. Colloquial, not literal, but that too. The battle is about to begin, and Regan tells Oswald to stay with her, but he says he must deliver Goneril's letter to Edmund. So Regan gives him a message for Edmund from herself. She tells Oswald, "I know your lady does not love her husband, and she gave most speaking looks to noble Edmund. But my lord is dead. Edmund and I have talked, and more convenient is he for my hand than for your lady's." She also tells Oswald to kill that blind traitor, as she will reward whoever does it. As he exits, he says he hopes to meet Gloucester so that he can show what party he does follow. To begin Act 4, Scene 5, Edgar, now wearing clothes of a peasant, presumably a present from the old man from the act's first scene, leads Gloucester. Edgar tells Gloucester that they are climbing toward the cliffs of Dover, but Gloucester feels the ground is even. Gloucester is suspicious. The ground's even, he can't hear the sea Edgar speaks of, and even Edgar's voice is altered, and he speaks in better phrase and matter than thou didst. To distract him from the truth, Edgar stands Gloucester at what he claims is the very verge of the cliff. Gloucester kneels and renounces the world, and in what he thinks will be his final words, calls for the gods to bless Edgar. Gloucester falls forward, and Edgar speaks to him in a new and different voice, as if he has just found the old man on the beach. Gloucester wants to be left alone to die, but this new man says that he has watched Gloucester fall, and that survival is what was meant to be, as Gloucester's life's a miracle. Into this reunion comes another old man, Lear, mad, crowned with weeds, and speaking gibberish. Gloucester recognizes the voice, asking, "Is it not the king?" To which Lear answers, "Aye, every inch a king." Lear then launches into a madly bawdy speech about adultery and sex. The ensuing conversation between the blind and the mad breaks Edgar's heart. And after all the matter and impertinency mixed, Lear recognizes Gloucester. A gentleman with attendants enters and attempts to take Lear into custody, but the old man runs off. Only they were part of Cordelia's army, not those meaning to do him harm. The attendants chase Lear, leaving the gentleman to tell Edgar of the impending battle before he too leaves. The meeting with Lear seems to have helped Gloucester, who no longer wants to die. As the still and newly disguised Edgar begins to take Gloucester to safety, Oswald enters and states his intention to destroy Gloucester. Edgar intervenes and ends up mortally wounding Oswald. Before the steward dies, though, he asks Edgar to deliver the letters in his possession to Edmund. Edgar reads the letter from Goneril and discovers her plot to have Edmund kill Albany to save her from being a prisoner and Albany's bed her jail. Edgar vows to deliver the letter to Albany, then leads his father to safety. And though he continually calls Gloucester father, it's generally consumed here that this is just a term of endearment and that he has not revealed himself to his father yet. The sixth and final scene of Act 4 takes us back to the French camp, where Cordelia thanks Kent, still disguised, but she knows who he is, for his goodness to the king. Kent will not reveal his identity to the rest of the world until later, he says, till time and he thinks meet. The captured, but now sleeping Lear is brought in, and Cordelia marvels at him and how he's suffered. When he wakes, she speaks to him. At first, he thinks she's a spirit, but he slowly comes around to recognizing both Cordelia and Kent. When Cordelia cries with joy, Lear misinterprets the gesture and begs for a chance to make it right. "If you have poison for me, I will drink it. I know you do not love me, for your sisters have, as I do remember, done me wrong. You have some cause. they have not. His raging madness is gone, and father and daughter are reunited. And you could end the play here, reasonably happily, as many productions did for the next two centuries, but more on that in the weeks to come. But that ain't the way Willie Shakes ended it. Remember, it's the tragedy of King Lear we're reading here, so happily ended is not in our future. And our Act 5 is much, much darker. Act 5 begins in the British camp, where there is some question by Reagan and Edmund as to Albany's course. More importantly, to Reagan at least, is the question of Edmund's love for Goneril. He denies anything beyond honored love for Goneril, and certainly denies ever finding his place to her forfended place, sex. Reagan pleads for him not to be familiar with her sister, but before much more of this pseudo-soap opera talk can go on, Goneril, Albany, and their soldiers arrive. Albany has news that Cordelia has been reunited with Lear, and the armies begin to leave for battle. Edgar enters disguised and asks to speak with Albany alone. He gives Albany the letter from Goneril to Edmund, telling the Duke to read the letter before the battle. If they win the battle, asks that he be presented to provide a champion that will prove what is avouched in the letter. Albany agrees, Edgar leaves, Edmund re-enters to call Albany to battle. When Albany exits, Edmund delivers a short soliloquy that continues our soap opera interruptus. To both these sisters have I sworn my love. He knows that he is causing conflict between the two sisters and ponders where all this will go. More importantly, though, he's concerned about the mercy which Albany intends to Lear and to Cordelia. If the British forces capture the two, Edmund declares that they will never see his pardon. The short second scene of the act takes us to the battlefield, where Edgar attempts to find Gloucester and some safety during the battle, knowing that Lear and Cordelia have been captured. It seems Edgar still hasn't revealed his true identity. The final scene of the play is back in the British camp, where Edmund and his soldiers have captured Lear and Cordelia. Edmund orders them to prison. Cordelia wants to confront her sisters, but Lear just wants to go to prison if it means that he can spend time with Cordelia. He paints an idyllic picture of the two of them. We'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh. The two are taken away. Goneril, Albany, Reagan enter with soldiers. Albany demands Edmund's prisoners, and when Edmund puts him off, Albany says that while Edmund may be a subject of this war, he's not as a brother. This attempt to pull rank is unsuccessful, however, as Reagan vouches for Edmund since he has borne the commission of her place and person. Goneril takes it a step further, saying that Edmund's acts doth exalt himself more than in Reagan's addition. Nothing like a domestic military catfight. Reagan says that she'd really let Goneril have it if she was feeling better. Lady, I am not well. That doesn't sound good. Keep that in mind. Meanwhile, the domestic sniping continues. Goneril, mean you to enjoy him? Albany, the let alone lies not in your goodwill. Edmund, nor in thine, lord. Albany, half-blooded fellow, yes. And why does Albany feel this is his business? Well, this is the moment Albany arrests Edmund on charges of capital treason and implicates Goneril. Then, saying that Edmund is armed, Albany calls for trumpets to sound to call forth a champion to engage Edmund in trial by combat. And if none shows up, Albany pledges to fight him himself. Reagan then calls out that she is sick. Goneril responds in aside, if not, I'll ne'er trust medicine. It seems Goneril is not just a serpent, as Albany claims, but a venomous one at that. Edmund accepts Albany's challenge, Reagan is taken away, and a herald enters to read the challenge for a champion for the trial by combat. And Edgar enters in armor with his face shield down and accepts the challenge. When asked, Edgar says that his name is lost by treason's tooth bare gnawn and canker bit, yet is he noble. After a quick duel of words, they fight, and Edgar defeats Edmund, wounding him badly, but leaving him alive. Goneril calls out that this doesn't count, saying that the laws are mine, not thine, when Albany attempts to enter her letter into the discussion. She exits, with attendants in pursuit. Edmund admits his crimes and says to his vanquisher, If thou art noble, I do forgive thee. Edgar reveals himself, and Albany says that he knew it all along. Methought thy very gait did prophesy a royal nobleness. Yeah, right. Edgar then recounts how he nursed his father after his torture, and how his father's heart failed when he finally revealed his identity. Final scene, death number one, thankfully offstage. Edmund is moved to do good, but before he can, a man comes in with a bloody knife that had been used by Goneril to kill herself. Final scene, death number two, again thankfully offstage. And she did this over the guilt of poisoning her now dead sister, Regan. Final scene, death number three, offstage, but we kind of saw this one coming. When the bodies are brought forth, Edmund says, "Yet Edmund was beloved." Was Edmund's villainy all about love? Regardless, Kent enters as himself before Edmund is borne off to die, no question. He tells Albany of the death sentence for Lear and Goneril so that it can be stopped in time. But no such luck. Lear enters carrying the dead Cordelia. Final scene, death number four. Offstage, but no less brutalizing to the audience. Lear tries to convince everyone, including himself, that she's still alive, but she's not. He feels guilt over her death, not just because of all that has happened in the play, but because he didn't act quickly enough. He killed the hangman to get Cordelia's body. Final scene, death number five. Offstage, and, well, wow, given the fact that Lear's so old. Kent reveals himself to Lear, who recognizes him, but little else, merely agreeing with news of his daughter's deaths. Word arrives that Edmund succumbed to his wounds. Final scene, death number six, offstage, unexpected, and for most in the audience, I'm guessing, silently applauded. Albany announces that he's resigning his powers to give back to Lear, but Lear, babbling almost incoherently over the body of Cordelia, dies. Final scene, death number seven, and the only one on stage befitting the tragedy that bears his name. His plan foiled by fate, Albany then says that he plans to split the kingdom between Kent and Edgar, but Kent feels that he will be dead soon enough. My master calls me, I must not say no. Final scene, death number eight, and that leaves Edgar with the last words of the play, maybe, but more on that later in our discussions. The weight of this sad time we must obey, speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. The oldest hath borne most, we that are young shall never see so much nor live so long. It's a fitting speech for both the end of the play and the beginning of a new reign. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects, including Othello the Wrap-Up, Othello by the Numbers, New Month, New Play, King Lear Initial Thoughts, King Lear Act 1, Scenes 1 and 2, Plot Synopsis, Making Mistakes, Podcast 123, Interview with Seamus Sullivan, co-writer and producer of Titus and Dronicus, King Lear, Act 1, The Rest, Plot Synopsis, Bad Behavior. King Lear, Act 2, Plot Synopsis, Dark Clouds Rising. How about a song? What, are you leery? Book Review, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606 by James Shapiro. King Lear, Act 3, Plot Synopsis, Rain and Blood. The Guardian, King Lear, Roger Ailham. King Lear, Act 4, Plot Synopsis, Reunions. And you could end it here, please. End it here. Scheduled viewing, PBS's Shakespeare Uncovered, King Lear. King Lear, Act 5, Plot Synopsis, Deaths. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 20th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.